We know the physical toll that working as a firefighter can bring, but the emotional toll can be even worse. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network. Our guest has witnessed the struggles firefighters face. He is Gregory Renz, a multi-decorated 28-year veteran of the Milwaukee Fire Department. Since his retirement, he's pursued his love of storytelling, and he's here to talk about his new novel, Beneath the Flames. Have you fought fires? What can you share about that experience? What questions do you have about the process of writing this book? Well, we'd like to hear from you, so give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, thanks so much for coming today, Greg.
Oh, this is wonderful. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really going to enjoy this.
Well, good, good. I hope you do. Well, first of all, why did you become a firefighter?
That's a good question. When I was actually, I graduated from the University of Wisconsin, and I was a pre-med student at the time, and did not get accepted into med school.
Oh, that happens to a lot of people.
Yeah. So I was looking for work, mm-hmm. and my first wife, her mom lived in Milwaukee.
Okay.
And saw an ad in the newspaper about firefighting and suggested maybe I might be interested in doing that. Before that, never had any ideas of being a firefighter. That was the first I ever found out about it. So I applied and got accepted into the first class and learned a lot about the job and fell in love with it.
You almost have to, don't you?
You really do. You know, I would, you know, with your lead in, if you don't mind, I'd like to read a short note from a firefighter who's read the book.
Oh,
and
sure.
You're talking about the toll it takes on firefighters.
Yeah, go ahead.
And this just came in like a week ago, and he had just read the book, and he's a well-respected fire officer, retired now. And so here's what he said to me. He said, "I shed tears reading this book, but your ending really blew me away. It's a powerful book for anyone. Was especially powerful for me, and I think will be likewise for our brothers and sisters in the fire service. I appreciate how your story presents the topic of PTSD. I had a tough time near the end of my career. Once I accepted and understood my own pain, I started seeing it in the eyes of our most senior guys. It continues to be a challenge for me. Your story has been serious therapy, and like therapy, it's not always easy, but healing. The themes of risk, loss, and redemption are universal, but they apply to the story of firefighters everywhere and strike deep chords in me. As I pass the unlikely landmarks only we firefighters see, I think of problems that will never be solved. The vacant lots where we risked it all in a house fire, alleys that were the scenes of murders, homes of suicides, and intersections where we pried bodies from cars. The scenes of so many calls where we met the devil in the dark. We carry that darkness in a corner of our hearts. Your book helps open a window to that corner, letting the light of day disinfect and heal us. So, like your image of leaves in a flowing stream suggests, there's hope, things to acknowledge and let go of. Thanks. I know this book will be both be appreciated by and good for the fire service. I think will give civilians real insight into the weights so many of us carry."
Wow, that's amazing.
And that really wasn't a major. Plot layer.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like it's really been resonating with especially retired firefighters. All of a sudden,
sure.
I'm hearing from a lot of them about the memories, the dark memories they've carried and things they've buried over the years. And after reading the book, they said, you know what? I really needed to read this because I needed to bring this to the surface again, acknowledge them, and hopefully heal and get over them.
Is that a bit of self-preservation, burying those feelings when you're on the job?
I think so because, you know, early in my career, there was no sources of defusing situations and, helping us deal with these issues. And so we were expected to tough it out. And, there's no crying on the fire department back then. And so we did, and we used black humor for the most part to deal with it. And probably not, most people hear that black humor, that's pretty sick stuff. But, it was how we dealt with it.
Yeah, and you're not alone with that. I know police officers that do the same thing.
Right.
And, yeah, when you deal with trauma, you have to have coping mechanisms.
Right.
So what's the best thing about being a firefighter, and what's the worst thing?
Well, I think the best thing is on a regular basis. I mean, you're really making a difference in people's lives at the worst possible times in their lives. So when we get called, this is probably going to be the most dramatic, horrible situation in our entire lifetimes. And we're going to be responding to that, especially at the busy houses, on a daily basis. So that's the good side, is that you're really making a huge difference in people's lives, and you're using your skills and, you know, all of your skills and things you've learned over the years to be able to do that. And the downside is the same thing. Mm-hmm. You're responding to all these really hypersensitive situations, and now you've got to somehow deal with that. And it's not always so easy. And I think different personalities deal with it in different ways, because talking with people, some people really, it bothers them. You know, with this PTSD thing, over my career, I think I lost 7 friends to suicide.
Oh.
And so for folks like that, it really affected them deeply. And you would never know it talking to them. It's totally buried. And so that's, you know, that's both the good and the bad, is you help a lot of people, but you also possibly have a lot of problems that occur because of that.
Sure. You were a firefighter for 28 years. Now, that's a pretty long time. Is that common?
That's kind of on the long side. yeah, I was toward the end of the career, I was told by the younger guys, hey, why don't you retire and give a young guy a job, for crying out loud? But I loved the job. I was very passionate. I loved it. And it finally got to the point where I just got too old for it. You know, it does take its toll physically and psychologically. Mm-hmm. We're sleep deprived. And, of course, all that constant tension of, you know, these traumatic situations, it does weigh on you. And it just got to the point where I realized it was time.
Yeah. So are you volunteering now?
No. Been there,
that's
done
it.
That.
You're done.
Yeah. Now my career is writing.
Writing.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I think people have a certain image of firefighting. You think, well, obviously fires, but you do a whole lot more than just that. What are some of the things that they probably don't know about that job?
Well, EMS services are by far the most, you know, the highest number of runs we get. I think it's probably 60-70% of our runs are EMS, maybe even more than that. So we have to be trained in emergency medical technology.
Mm-hmm.
And that there again, you're making huge differences in people's lives, because you're responding to some of the most amazing traumatic situations you can imagine, and some really, you know, some pretty tragic situations too, where it just tears your heart out. You know, one of the runs we had, I remember getting called to it, and this young woman got a call from her husband that, oh, I'm not feeling good. And she said, well, go to the hospital. And then she didn't hear from him. So she went home and found him, and he had a heart attack. So we responded. When we got there, we couldn't save him. He was a young man. This just came out of the blue. And she just asked me, she said, when we were all done with all of our, you know, equipment and doing everything, she said, could I just lie down next to him for a while?
Oh,
and
God.
She did, and I still have that vision in my head.
Oh.
Just watching her lie next to her husband with her arms draped over him.
Yeah, gives me goosebumps.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. I mean, seeing that day after day after day.
Yeah,
that's really hard. So you decided to retire. Did you have this plan of writing when you decided to do that?
No. It's kind of set in. I was involved in a dramatic rescue of 2 little boys from a burning basement. And, well, they like to give you awards for these things.
I like the way you say that. Yeah, I was involved with this. Blah, blah, blah. It's like, so, it was a pretty big thing, Greg.
Well, okay. So, anyway, they have to give speeches at these award ceremonies. And the first time I did this, I think there was a room of 200 people. We had media there and everything. And my chiefs told me, said, now don't just get up there and say, I was just doing my job. Because that's what we tend
to
say.
That's what you do.
Yeah, we all say that. And he said, tell the story, because this is really a good story. So I told the story. And as I'm telling it, I'm just feeling this, the emotion in the room. And I'm looking out over the room, and I'm seeing some tears coming down people's faces. And I realized, whoa. The power of story and how you can connect with people and how it's coming back to me by telling this story. It just really inspired me to think, you know, if I could learn how to do that on a page, what a powerful, powerful thing that could be. So when I retired, that's when I thought, you know what, maybe I should write a novel. You know, I've got all these experiences, all these colorful characters I worked with, a lot of inner city experiences. I thought, yeah, you know what? I think I might like to write a novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how hard could that really be?
Oh, silly man.
Yeah. you got that right. So here we are 10 years later.
Ten years.
Yeah,
wow,
yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Were you always good? I mean, when you tell a joke or when you tell a story, people always listen to you, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, and that was part of it, too. I mean, when I would tell fire stories, I realized people were very engaged with social occasions. Mm-hmm. People, well, you got a story for me, and you know, you start telling stories. And every firefighter can probably relate to the same thing because, you know, it's really a part of the culture of firefighting is storytelling because we spend a lot of time amusing each other.
Sitting around, right?
And those stories really get better over time. It's like you hear a story of one time and then 2 years later you hear the same story and go, wait a minute. But they get better. So
of course. I was there, but I don't remember it, right?
Quite like that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it does take a certain type of person to tell a good story, don't you think?
Oh, there are storytellers. Yeah, I worked with some phenomenal storytellers in a job. Oh, and they could hold your attention for hours. They inherently knew what I learned later was story structure with plot points and midpoints and all those things and twists. They just inherently knew that and could tell a story early. And I think I learned a lot about storytelling from them. But some of these guys were probably on the verge of being illiterate, so there's no way they could have ever written a novel.
Written down. Yeah. Well, they passed on that to you, so you could do it, right?
Right. I think that was the plan, yeah.
Well, we're talking about firefighting today with author Greg Renz. His new novel is called Beneath the Flames. What comments do you have about firefighting or about novel writing, for that matter? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Jane Rotunda is our on-air producer today, and Nigel O'Shea is our technical director. After 11:45, we'll talk to another author. She has written a book about choosing to not have children. Hope you can stay with us on the Ideas Network. But right now, let's get back to talking with Greg Renz about his book. Now, let's talk about the book, actually. Give us a little synopsis about what the plot involves.
Oh, sure. So this is the story of a small town dairy farmer and volunteer firefighter who experiences a horrible tragedy at a neighboring farmhouse, and he blames himself for the horrible outcome. And to seek redemption, he joins the Milwaukee Fire Department, hoping to prove that he's not a coward and a loser. And he's assigned to the very busiest firehouse in the inner city, the Corps, and quickly finds out he's in way over his head. The poverty, the violence, all of the, you know, it's just too much. The fires are just scarier than heck, and he's ready to quit within weeks. And his salvation comes in the form of a 12-year-old inner-city girl on the verge of joining a street gang. She brings her little sister over to the firehouse for mentoring. Now, these two people from very diverse backgrounds, culturally miles apart, can't stand each other. I mean, she's up in his face telling him he doesn't know anything about teaching these inner city kids that stuff, that crap he's telling them ain't going to help them at all. And he doesn't appreciate her being up in his face. So they start out on horrible terms. But the nice thing is, or what really works is the nice character arc where the two of them, she realizes that he really does want to help her sister. And so over time, she starts helping him tutor the kids. And now those huge cultural boundaries, the walls start crumbling and they start realizing they're more alike than different. And so the story centers on these two coming together, trying to figure out how they can lift each other from their hopeless lives. So it's not just a firefighter coming in and saving somebody. It's a much deeper story than that.
When you started this journey, did that story, was the basis there, or did it come to you as you worked on it?
I would say the basis was there. And, you know, you have writers tend to either be outliners or pantsers, you know, where you write by the seat of your pants.
Uh-huh.
I was somewhere in between. I had a pretty good idea where I wanted the story to go. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because as I got deeper and deeper into the writing of the story, it changed dramatically.
Oh, sure.
My gosh. Mm-hmm. The walk-on characters became major players. They demanded more attention.
Mm-hmm.
They one of the favorite characters, my readers tell me, is Miss Burney. She was Mitch's black landlady, and that she was just going to be a walk-on character.
Really?
And then I had some beta readers say, you know, I just love her.
She's great. Yeah.
And so she became his mentor rather than his captain, which was the original idea, because that would have been kind of cliche, your captain's your mentor. So
having an
inner-city black lady be the mentor, turned out to, I thought, be a real nice twist.
Well, it is kind of nice when you kind of get an unexpected person being the but I think, you know, maybe we've all know sort of a Miss Bernie in our lives that kind of you don't think is maybe a leader, but obviously right. really, really is.
Right.
So let's talk about your main character, Mitch.
Right.
Who did you base him on?
Well, probably a little bit of me, but
I was wondering
I really
about that.
Have to point out, though, it's like most of this book is based upon my experiences. Mm-hmm. I mean, based on my experiences and based on other firefighters' experiences whose stories I shared.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to make this perfectly clear. The firehouse sex scene is not based on experiences. My wife made sure that I
tell that to everybody.
Yes.
I got it. Well, I did have that question written down. I was wondering about
Yeah. So, but what I found interesting about, and I think that, you know, writing from the rural area and contrasting that with the inner city, you know, the difference in growing up in this lush rural landscape and then growing up in the inner city, to me, that was one of the very strongest aspects of the story. And so by taking Mitch and making the rural countryside the source of his pain and agony and misery, and the inner city, the core, the disintegrating, decaying inner city, the source of his hope and redemption.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that whole idea.
Sure. So did you start off in the country yourself, or are you a city boy?
I never lived in the country, okay. but had a lot of contacts with the country. I spent summers up on my grandmother's farm up in Chautauqua, and so, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So without giving, you know, too much away, obviously, people die in this book. I mean, there's quite major characters that
yes.
die in this book. Why did you decide to do that? I mean, most, you know, I mean, well, you write a TV show or something. Obviously,
right.
you don't get rid of your main characters. Well, most shows don't.
Right.
We're not even going to talk about some of the ones that you. But right. why did you decide to do that?
It almost seemed like the story took on a life of its own and demanded I go with that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the characters I killed off, I loved. I mean, I spent a lot of time developing them, and I knew them very well, and to lose them was as hard on me as the readers. And, you know, I had readers, you know, say the same thing. I can't believe you killed such and such.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God, I love that character so
mm-hmm.
much. But for the realism of the inner city and, you know, how the crime and everything that's going on down there, it really played into the story, and I couldn't, you know, whitewash that at all.
Yeah, I agreed. I think reading it, if you hadn't killed off those characters, mm-hmm. it would be so much more of a fairy tale.
Absolutely, yes. And I, you know, for me too, it's like tragedy stick in my head much more than, you know, happy-go-lucky stories.
Sure,
you know,
yeah. Well, so, it is more real.
Right.
We do have a little bit of both.
But,
so.
You know, Robert Olin Butler, I worked with him. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner. And he said, be careful when you kill characters because you need to earn it.
Ah,
and I've seen in some of these television series where they don't earn this. And I'm pointing it out to my wife, and she doesn't like me talking during movies and stuff because I tend to point this stuff out. But yeah, I'm told to keep quiet. But yeah, it's like he said, you can kill off really, you know, likable characters, but make sure you earn it before you do that. Don't mm-hmm. just all of a sudden have something come out of the blue where they're taken out of the story.
Yeah. So explain that a little bit more. How do you earn it?
You earn it by setting it up. I mean, you're going to get your readers invested in the character, first of all, and then you're going to start filtering in situations, dangerous situations, where they may come close, and then they aren't killed, but it's kind of a foreshadowing that there's something dark coming here. So, yeah, I think foreshadowing is huge when you're doing that, and sometimes you have to go back and as you're rewriting, because, well, this novel's been rewritten. I couldn't even, the first chapter is close to 50 times.
Oh, my revision. Gosh.
Yeah,
wow,
just over
that's a lot.
And over and over again. So, yeah, that's when you go back and kind of slide in some stuff where you get, okay, I can foreshadow with this. And then later on when this happens, you go, yeah, I didn't want that to happen, but I can see why it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, it makes for a better read for the reader.
I think so.
I think. Better journey. Better
yes,
journey.
Absolutely.
Which characters were difficult for you to find?
Oh, gosh. It'd be hard to point that out simply because I knew most of these characters
okay.
in one way or another. So Kyle was difficult, and the reader will understand why that was a difficult thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out, you know, I always asked readers who their favorite characters are, and I had one reader say that Kyle was her favorite character.
Really?
And it's not a major role, but it
really
affected her.
Yeah, you know, it kind of tugs at your heart a little bit,
right?
Just
right.
for this whole circumstances.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
yeah.
So I mean, those they weren't hard to write, but I would say somewhat painful. Like they say, well, you have read that if there's no tears in the author's eyes, there's going to be no tears in the reader's eyes. And I was bawling my eyes out at times when I was writing some of these scenes. It was that emotional for me.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So you had mentioned earlier, there's a few steamy scenes in the book.
Yes.
Why did you consider that important for you to include?
Well, I think for the realism again, because you're talking about a young man's journey, and he's fixated on sex. I mean, as a 22-year-old, sex is a big deal for this young man, and he's got to learn the difference between sex and love, and what those two things mean, and it's part of his journey. And if I had not put in the sex scenes, I don't think that would have been quite so powerful of a message.
Mm-hmm. So the character of Nick, which is a female firefighter.
Yes.
Really? Was there a firefighter like Nick that you knew?
No, that's fictionalized. That's
okay, pretty, yeah, I kind of thought.
Yeah,
so.
right. But you know what I did with her, too? I didn't want her just to be this beautiful young lady that's on the fire department. I mean, as you read the book, you realize she's a hell of a firefighter. I mean, she's very gifted, she's very courageous, and a very, very strong person. So, yeah, I didn't want her just to be this sex symbol in the book.
Yeah, she's definitely not two-dimensional.
Yeah.
She's physically pretty perfect, which,
I'll
give you that.
Okay.
I'll give you that.
Yeah, there's been a few others that said, man, that's almost over the top.
Where's those flaws? But, that's okay. What did your wife think? What did she think about the whole idea of you becoming a writer?
Well, for the first 2 years I started on this journey, she did not know. She was still working in Milwaukee. We were living in Lake Mills.
My goodness.
And I was taking courses at the UW in creative writing.
Uh-huh.
Because it's kind of intimidating to tell somebody, I'd like to be a writer and I'd like to write a book. So I didn't even tell her about it for the first 2 years. And I really sucked, I should add. Because I would get, the UW Continuing Studies program is phenomenal. And anyway, the first couple courses I took, the papers had come back all marked up. Greg, you really need to work on your punctuation, syntax, your point of view's all over the place, your grammar. But then it would end with, but these stories are so wonderful. Please keep writing.
Mm-hmm.
So after 2 years, I started getting a little bit better. And after, I think the third or fourth year, my writing coach, Christine Desmet, suggested I submit some of my work to the Writers Institute writing contest. And that's a huge conference, 400 people from around the country, some from England and Australia have been there.
Mm-hmm.
And thought, so I'm going to put, these are really good writers, gifted writers, and some are published authors, and I'm going to put my stuff in here, really? So I did.
Uh-huh.
And Laurie Shear, the director of the conference, is announcing the winners. She was third place, second place. She looks over at me and she says, Greg, you won first place in fiction.
Oh, my gosh.
And I look behind me because
there's got another Greg.
There had to be. She says, no, you, Greg. And then later, she got to nonfiction and went third place, second place. Yeah, again, Greg. You won first place in nonfiction. So that was a validation I really needed.
Yeah,
maybe I can do this. Because just about every author, I mean, the writing community in Madison is phenomenal. I have so many friends. And we all have the same things. We pretty much hate our writing.
That's a good thing, though. I found doing things, whatever I've done in my life, that they're never good enough, which is good.
Yeah.
If you like it too much, I think that's a bad sign, isn't it?
There's been a few writers I talked to who were really high in their writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was
they worry me.
It was not so good. But I think you have to have that. But you can go too far with that, too.
Well, true.
Because that can paralyze you to the point where you don't write. So you got to find that thing where you can look at your writing with a critical eye, but not with an eye that makes you freeze up or you walk away from that. And that was like the biggest thing. I had to, my coach, Christine Desmet, told me as I got into this, you have to start looking at this as your job and your career now. Just like on a fire department where you punched in, you need to go to work every day to your desk and sit down for a set period of time. So I did, and I set hours from 9 till noon every day, usually ran beyond that. And that's when I started becoming very productive. Had I just written when I felt like it, I would never have finished this novel. And I found some days I would sit for 2 hours plunking away. That's crap. delete it, plunk away. That's crap. And then that last hour, all of a sudden, this stuff just comes out of the air. It's like it came out of nowhere, like a scene, like one of the scenes in the novel, and it just boom. Amazing. Oh, now I see it. Oh my gosh! But it's not like I logically thought my way through it. It just dropped into my head.
Amazing.
Yeah.
We're talking to Gregory Lee Renz. He is a multi-decorated 28-year veteran of the Milwaukee Fire Department. And since his retirement, he's been pursuing his love of storytelling. And his new novel is called Beneath the Flames. Do you have a comment or question for Greg? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So let's talk a little bit more about this process. Now, you decided to write a book. How long ago did you say?
That would be over 10 years
ago.
Yeah.
Okay. You retired young. You don't look that old.
Oh, well, thank you.
So 10 years. Where are you finding all of this ambition to do this? I mean, when you first start out and you're getting all these red marks on your pages, I mean, what was inside of you? Does that have something to do with being a firefighter?
Well, yeah, I think so. What you learn on the fire department is you never give up.
You never give up.
Yeah. You might change tactics and you might go from offensive to defensive, but you never ever go, okay, that's it. We give up. So I think that persistence was huge, and I think it's probably the most important characteristic of any writer is persistence, because
yes,
you can have all the talent in the world, you can have a great story, but if you don't have the persistence to push through those tough times, and you're going to have tough times.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to hate yourself at times and beat yourself up. I think that I learned a lot of lessons on the fire department about just keep working through. And I think the passion for the story. And then once I started getting into the story itself demanded my attention. That, like I said before, it took on a life of its own.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that from so many authors, that it's kind of a magic moment when all of a sudden everything's real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, when my wife and I would go out to eat, once she knew I was writing, then I started sharing things with her and sharing scenes with her. So she's my very first editor. She sees the pages before anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever we would go out to eat, just about every time we went out to eat, we talked about the book and the characters as if they were real people. Because
sure,
to us, they were.
Yeah.
And she would give me critiques about, I don't know if Mitch would do that or say that. And, I would dig in a little bit. But then a couple of days later, after letting it kind of work, maybe she was right on that. So, it's been a joint effort. It's our book, not my book.
That's wonderful. And speaking of getting, critiques and stuff, you're in a white writer's group. What has that done for you as a writer?
Well, being in a writer's group, you really do need other people reading your material. I think without that, you don't know what's good and what's bad, because some of the stuff that resonated the best with people, I didn't think was that good. And some of the things that I thought were pretty good, it's like, I really didn't get that scene. It's like, oh, darn. So you really do need that input. And I think there's probably been about 20 beta readers for this.
Wow.
Other writers I've met who agreed to read it and give me feedback. And it's been through 4 professional editors, one on the West Coast who I met at a conference, 2 in Manhattan, who I met at a conference, a lot of conferences, one from the UW. So I had a lot of professional eyes on it. And the interesting thing about that is some of them totally disagreed on how I should go about this. I remember one editor saying, I wish you would drop into your protagonist's head a little more internal dialogue.
Uh-huh.
I thought, okay, because I tend not to do a lot of that. I just like action dialogue and let the reader fill in the gaps. And then, so I tried that and I started pushing it a little, not all the way, but the next editor 2 years later I worked with when it was getting close, his suggestion was, get rid of all that internal dialogue. You don't need that. It's like your action and dialogue speaks for itself. It's kind of like you're telling us what's obvious.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea with that was, if you're going to put internal dialogue in, make sure it's not in character. In other words, it goes against what's going on right now. If it's just going to confirm what he's doing and what's going on, well, that's redundant.
Yeah.
But if it's something totally opposite that you wouldn't expect him to be thinking this in this situation, well, then put it in.
That's a really good tip. Yeah, I guess I've never thought about it that way, but when I do think, it's like, that makes sense. It totally informs the character
inside.
Yeah. So you got your book. What was your next step?
Okay, so the process was, I think I was, once the book was done, it went out to queries, and I queried many, many agents and had 90 rejections. And I had two offers of representation, and one was from a very prominent New York agent who, when I sent him the query, said, beautifully written query, send me the manuscript. A week later, he called me on the telephone. This doesn't happen. Months later, you might get something.
Yeah.
Called me on the telephone. I said, I read some of your manuscript. Firefighter that can write like you, I can market. He says, I want to send you a contract this afternoon.
Uh-oh.
And I had researched the guy, and it's like six-figure contracts. He had all kinds of them.
Wow.
And great, you know, good authors and sold some movie deals. So he was a real deal.
Uh-huh.
And so I was feeling pretty good. And I thought, but let's talk. I'm not going to sign a contract just because I've heard too many horror stories. You know, being in the writing community, you hear some tough stories about people signing and terrible things happening. So I said, well, let's talk. And so we started talking about his vision of the story. And as we got deeper and deeper into it, you know, I didn't want this just to be a action commercial novel. I wanted it to be a much deeper novel, you know, as it's resonating with, you know, firefighters, with the PTSD. And, you know, actually, just to throw this in, too, I just talked with a lady who had grown up on her farms, on a farm, and had read it, said, I never dreamed life in the inner city was like that. So it's opening eyes to people. The only things they've seen are on television.
Right.
And she said, I never dreamed that's horrible what they have to go through.
Yeah.
And so it opened eyes. So anyway, we talked. We talked extensively, 3-hour-long conversations.
Wow.
And he kept telling me what I needed to do this story. And after the first hour-long conversation, I thought, okay, I'm going to try it. He wanted me to cut all the farm stuff, focus strictly on a firefighter in Milwaukee and rescuing kids and all that business. And I actually sat down and cut all that stuff out just for the heck of it and started it. And after 2 days, I was sick to my stomach going up to my writing desk and thinking, there's no way I can do this. I don't care how much money you might be able to assign this for. I just can't. And finally turned him down. And said,
wow, that's amazing.
And then my writing coach said, when you get tired of querying, I know a publisher in Milwaukee that would be thrilled to publish your novel. So sent her down the manuscript, and Christine sent her the recommendation. And she let me know, she said, yeah, I'm really not signing any more authors right now. But send me the manuscript anyway. I'll take a look at it. So a week later, she got back to me. She said, I love it. I want to publish it.
So, yay, finally.
Yes. And she's been wonderful to work with. It's like her top priority is to keep her authors happy,
wonderful.
Which is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And what's the name of the publishing company?
Henschel House.
Okay.
Yeah, Kira Henschel.
Give her a little call.
Oh, absolutely. She's wonderful.
Yeah.
So the next big step was sending it out for reviews to Kirkus, and I sent it out to Jacqueline Michard and Nicholas Butler, and so now it's, even after all of this work, it's going out into the world to the experts.
Yes.
Is it really any good?
Mm-hmm.
You know, my thing is, Kirkus, who can be really brutal, is going to tell me, yeah, Greg, nice try, keep working, maybe next time. I knew that's what I did.
Can't really put that on the jacket, can you?
No. So, yeah, I was kind of stressed out waiting for those, and then they came back just raving reviews.
Yeah.
Kirkus loved it, and
it's...
So now I can relax and go, okay, now I can feel confident selling and pitching this story because evidently it's pretty good.
Yeah, and you got Jacqueline's, who's been a guest with us a number of times. You've got her quote up here. And as most people know, she wrote The Deep End of the Ocean as well as others, but that one she's most known for. And she loved it.
Yes.
So, I mean, obviously that's very helpful. And you've been out and about. And you've talked about some of the reactions you've been getting. What's it been like for you to hear this?
Oh, it's really, well, that's probably the neatest thing about this is just having readers come up and share what they got out of the book, share what they enjoyed, share the characters. And it's interesting because you do get different perceptions of what the story was about. Like the firefighters are really looking at the PTSD, and other people are looking at the children and, you know, the effects on the children. And really, the PTSD does cover both the firefighters and children growing up in the inner city.
Sure.
And the more you learn about it, you realize that just that changes brain chemistry permanently when you're going through that stuff. So people are, I think it's opening a lot of eyes that I was hoping, but you never know if it's going to connect like that,
you know,
so far it is.
And you've been having tons of people. I mean, I've heard that it's standing room only when you're doing a presentation. So.
Yeah, that was the coolest thing was the Boswell book launch. And I didn't expect that. They booked the big guys for the, my publisher and publicist to get through to them. And actually, Liam Callan, a best-selling author, he put in a word for me also.
Ah.
And he was the one who moderated that, and he's well-known in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. So he moderated it, and I thought, well, if we can half fill the place, that'd be cool. Well, we had standing room only, over 120 people. They sold out of books.
That is crazy.
I mean, that was just over the top. Oh, gosh.
So does that mean you're thinking about a new one?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Well, yeah, after spending 10 years learning how to write, I probably better not just walk away from it now.
Exactly. Don't waste all that training.
Right.
Well, you do have some stuff coming up, and I had that written down, but I can't find it. Where are you going next?
Okay, tonight I'm going to be at the McFarland Library. That'll be at 6:30. And Wednesday, I actually have a day off.
Congratulations.
And then Thursday, I'm going down to Milwaukee to the Milwaukee Fire Department Historical Museum Society.
Neat.
And it's going to be at an old firehouse.
Very cool.
So that should be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And then I have my high school reunion that I might be able to talk at.
What a great time to have a high school reunion.
Yes,
you can kind of brag a little bit. Well, not that that's in your personality. Yeah.
And then Saturday, I should put in a word for paradiddles in Waterloo.
Oh, okay.
They're invited me from 2 till 4 for a little talk there.
Okay, paradiddles is...
It's a cafe.
Oh,
cafe,
okay.
Coffee
mm-hmm.
house.
Okay.
Right, I'm not sure. I think it's right on Main Street.
Yeah, but. Okay. And then if people want to catch up with you, see where you are, you do have a website,
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is...
glrenz.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
glrenz.com.
Yeah, and there's more information. And there's even a little snippet about your heroic rescue.
The videos of the telecasts are all on there.
Yeah,
so
it's pretty neat.
It's pretty neat to see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for coming in and talking about this book. I definitely enjoyed it. I recommend it.
Oh,
it's a good
you.
Book, no matter what kind of reading that you like to do. So I would definitely say go out and buy it. Okay.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Okay. Well, again, we've been talking with Gregory Renz. He's the author of the novel Beneath the Flames. And again, find out more about Greg and the book. His website is glrenz, RENZ.com. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, we look at the decision to not be a parent. Why people make that decision and how society reacts. Stay with us.